church. I signed the guest list. On the way in, I got my little visitor card. I expect to be contacted by our greeters. I'm glad that Grady mentioned that we're still praying for Sherry and for the kids and grandkids. I wasn't able to share with you during my first time back since this happened. Some of us older members will remember Myra Hamage, long-time member. She's been shut in for quite a while. Andy contacted me right before the last. She passed away. And Andy's with us for the first time in a long time. So as we're adding people to pray for in their grief, could you please add Andy to the list? We're going to have a memorial for Myra. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. You know, when the Spaniards first saw the Grand Canyon, eventually they needed to get water. And when you're at the Grand Canyon, where do you look for water? The river. And even when you're all the way up on the rim, doesn't the river look so close? It's right there. So the Spaniards did what everyone does when they first see it. We need water. There's a river there. Let's go get it. But you find out that when you hike to the bottom of the canyon, the river just keeps going where? It just keeps getting farther and farther and farther away. All the people that are killed in the Grand Canyon, an overwhelming majority were killed because they weren't prepared. It's because they didn't have enough. Thirst can drive us, and hunger can drive us, probably like nothing else can. If you're dying of thirst, or if you're starving without food, not much else matters, right? Not much else is going on. Thirst changes everything. So when you're in need like that, nothing else would. Nothing else matters. And to be in need is a fundamental opposition to being human. How many here love being in need? Absolutely none of us. We don't want to need. We don't need to need. We always want to be in what? We always want to be in control. We have to be in control. And so I'm not sure if you've noticed in our study on Torah's living covenant, if I were to ask you after our study right now, I know what the answer should be if we haven't been studying it for weeks, for 12 in-depth studies, if you will. But I just want you to ponder the answer to this question right now. How many here have seen themselves, at least, as receivers of this covenant? Just one, two, that's it. Really? Who did God design this covenant for? Just Abraham? No, it's all his children. And how many here is a child of Abraham? Well, you answer the question first. Not that you descend from Isaac, not that you have his DNA, but what makes you a child of Abraham is whether or not you have what? Faith. There we go. Pop quiz. Oh, it's good, good. So if I were to ask you, though, after we receive this covenant from God, what is our role? What are we supposed to do? I would say that probably instinct and probably not wanting to place ourselves in a position of need, the answer would be we have to what? We need to keep it. Right? That's what we would say. We need to keep it. But in our 12 studies, as we went from Adam and Eve to Noah, to Abram and Sarai, to Abraham and Sarah, and to Hagar, and last time we were together to Isaac, has any receivers of the covenant kept it? No. Absolutely not. And where in our study have we seen that any time that our fathers and mothers broke it, that God took the covenant away? So our role can't be to what? It can't be to keep it in order to have it. By the way, when Abraham was still Abram, God promised that he would keep the covenant after Abram broke it. Remember? Remember the flaming torch and the smoking pot? So how about this? How about our responsibility in the covenant is to have the faith that we need it. It's to always remember that we are in need. We need this. See, the listeners in Matthew 5 are his, what do we call those 12 guys in Matthew 5? They're his what? They're his disciples. They're his followers. They're the ones who said, that's the guy, this is the teacher, this is the rabbi, we're following him. That's what makes you a disciple of somebody. Which means it includes who? All of us here. Aren't we all disciples of Christ? How many are here but didn't sign up for that? I'll sign you up right now. Won't we, church? Amen. We're all disciples of Christ. And what gave me the reason that I had Glenda go back to chapter 4 is that all those people in chapter 4 that Glenda read us about, they were in some sort of what? They were in need. They were demon-possessed. They had diseases. And Jesus did what? He healed all of them. Do you think the disciples did the connection? When after the crowds, the only reason that the crowds are following is because they all recognize that they're sick. They all recognize that they're paralyzed. They all recognize that they're dying. They all recognize that they're possessed by demons. All of the physical needs that he's been taking care of, do you think the disciples recognize that the Sermon on the Mount now is him saying, you need to be as in need spiritually as every one of the people that you've seen me heal? That's why it's blessed to be in what? In need. It's blessed to be poor. Are you kidding me, really? I don't feel very blessed when I'm poor. I feel very blessed when I'm hungry. I don't feel very blessed when I'm thirsty. But Jesus said, the reason is that as long as we're in need, we have the faith that he will give it to us. By the way, that's what makes us keepers of the covenant. So, this covenant now, which last time we were together, was the first time that it was passed on to a son, an actual son, passed on to Isaac. Covenant is now worded this way as it's passed on to the very first grandson. So it says here in Genesis 28, and he dreamed that there was a stairway set up on earth, the top of it reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And the Lord stood beside him and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give you to you. I will give to you and your offspring. And your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And all the families of the earth shall be blessed in you and your offspring and your children. Know that I am with you. And I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have what? What I have promised to you. We recognize those words, don't we? Same words said to who? To his grandfather. So who now is this holder of the covenant? Who is this grand, noble patriarch given the covenant by the creator and the sustainer of all the universe? One of my favorite, probably my favorite patriarch. Then Isaac called Jacob, and he blessed him. Jacob in Hebrew, Yaakov. How many have heard Yaakov? There's about three Yaakovs in Fiddler on the Roof. Yaakov is a very, very popular Hebrew and Yiddish name. But it's not a good name to have. Because it literally means heal. Not, yes, this heal, and the other kind of heal. So is it ever good to be called a heal? Nope. Okay. Or heal grabber. And it literally means to assail insidiously or circumvent an overreacher or one who would take insidious advantage. How'd you like that name? That's you. That's the name that your parents put upon you. This is what it means. As a matter of fact, in Scripture, whenever you see it, I took this from the Jewish Publication Society, so their numbering is just a little bit different. In all of our translations, it would be verse 4, but in the Tanakh, it's verse 3, and it says, "Beware every man of his friend, trust not even a brother, for every brother takes advantage. Every friend is base in his dealings." If you were to read that literally, the brother who takes advantage of you, it says, "Every brother Jacob's." It's almost like his name is a verb. Jacob is one. He's a hero. He circumvents. He attacks. He takes advantage of. He deceives. Right? And we don't have time to go all through the all the deceptions. I'll just go off what we might know and we'll kind of refer back to it. But real quick, as we get to the point where he moves on, because remember where we were, where we read, where he got the covenant, when he sees the stairway to heaven, if you will, okay, he's on his way where? He's left his mother and father behind, and he's on this journey to go get his wife, right? And that's when God gives him the covenant while he's out in the wilderness. He got his father's blessing. And in a way, Jacob kind of passed on the covenant to him. But I think that Jacob, even in his blessing, said that it's not my covenant to give. And so God comes to Jacob in the wilderness. So what has his deception caused? Is he going there out of pleasure? Did he just wake up one day and said, "I'd like to meet the rest of my family"? No. His mom made him go. Why? Because that deception has led to something. It's led to a conflict with who? With his only brother. And how long has Jacob been doing this? How long has Jacob been fighting? How long has he been taking advantage of his brother? Well, you can argue he's been doing it since the womb. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and his wife Rebekah conceived. The children struggled together within her and said, "If this is to be the way, why do I live? I'm going to go talk to God about this." She gets to take part in the covenant the same way that her mother-in-law did. And everyone else, when she says, "This sucks. I got to talk to God about this." How long have they been fighting? They've been fighting that long. And Jacob has a unique way of fighting. He'll deceive. He'll cause the conflict. He'll grab. He will deceive, just like his name. He will take advantage of. Because that blessing that Isaac put on Jacob, it was meant for who? It was meant for Esau. But Esau sold his birthright to Jacob. Now, you can say that Esau's a grown man. He can do what he wants. But was he of sound mind and body when he signed over his birthright to Jacob? No. He was starving. And Jacob knew it. I don't know about you. I try not to make decisions when I'm hangry. And if he had given Esau a Snickers, maybe Esau wouldn't have been so quick. But Jacob knew exactly what he was doing, didn't he? So this deception, he deceives in order to get what he wants, but and the way that he deals with the conflict that the deception is that he what? He runs. He avoids it. So the holder of the covenant, the keeper of the covenant, of the God of the universe, is now this heel. This heel grabber, this advantage taker of her, the covenant holder, going from his father Isaac, which we thought was a hero, remember? Only messed up once. He still what? Still messed up. Still didn't have faith, right? Now goes to this lion little mama's boy. result, he saw what? Hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will what? Kill my brother Jacob. That's what he hears on his way out the door. On his way in this journey, if you will. So he deceives. And then the conflict that the deception starts, he solves it by what? By not solving it. By running and taking care and going on and moving on to do what? To take advantage of somebody else. He runs away to Rebekah's relatives, his relatives. And does that solve the conflict in his life? He's there. He's gone for nearly 20 years. Does it solve anything? No. Esau still hates him. The damage is all still done. And by the way, when he gets there, he's still making friends and influencing people. Jacob heard that the sons of Laban is remember, we met Laban before, it's Rebekah's brother. Laban were saying, Jacob has taken all that was our father's. He has gained all this wealth from what belonged to our father. And Jacob saw that Laban did not regard him as favorably as he did before. The heel is still at work. Now, granted, Laban's no cupcake himself, is he? But it cracks me up, it really cracks me up. And even in the base rules of karma, Jacob is now up against somebody who's a bigger deceiver than he is. He's now up against a manipulator who's better at it than he is, his uncle. If Jacob could be just a little bit more humble, he might look at Laban and go, man, that guy, I thought I was good, but that dude. Because Jacob was conned into working 14 years to get the daughter that was promised to him to be his wife. Right? And Laban just kept doing it. Laban just kept getting away with it. So he does all of this after 14 years. He finally gets the daughter that he was promised. He has a bunch of kids from the two daughters themselves, from Leah and Leah's servant, and Rachel and Rachel's servant. And when they get all the way down to the son that he really wanted, all the way down to Joseph and Benjamin, it's time to do what? It's time to go. He's not going to solve the conflict or resolve the conflict with his father-in-law. What's he going to do? He's going to run. Now, you can argue with me. You can say, well, Craig, God told him to run. God said to Jacob, return to the land of your ancestors and to your kindred, and I will what? And I will be with you. Jacob is told to run, but how does he decide to do it? What is his plan? How's he going to pull this off? He does the only thing that he knows how to do. Guess what he does? He's going to Jacob the heck out of this plan. He's going to Jacob it. It's the only way. Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. Was that God's idea? God said go home, but he said, hey, first go lie to Laban. So the deception causes conflict. The conflict always gets Jacob to do what? To move on. To go on. And by the way, when it comes later, when all of this is going to come to, he blames God for this. He does. You're the one that told me to go home. It's funny. He lies to Laban. He deceives him to get away, right? And then a little later, he's going to tell God, you were the one that told me to go home. This is just Jacob. But in all that we know about him, everything that you do, be completely honest. And if you're getting a little uncomfortable that this guy is a patriarch, that he's the keeper of the covenant, what do we forget? There's something that we tend to forget. In that in the middle of all of this, in the journey, even the deception of the journey, even him not resolving anything, even him being who he is, look what happens. Jacob went on his way. The angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, what? This is whose camp? This is God's camp. And he called that place Mahanaim. Mahanaim is for the two angels that he saw. Forget about this picture. He's not a very likable character. Is that God still hanging with his boy? God picked him, and God's still hanging with them. God is with them. He's walking with them. He's talking with them. He told them the thing that makes the covenant, Jacob, was that I get to walk with you in it. I walked with your grandfather. I walked with your father. I'll give you the covenant as long as you let me be with you. I will be with you. So God is with him. And he's got him going home. But he's not going to do what God wants him to do. I believe that God is having him go home. Why? It's time. It's time to do something about it. He's got to get him back in the neighborhood because the one day eventually the covenant is going to include that land. So he's got to get him back just for the land, right? Just for geographical reasons. Do you think God wants this conflict to go unresolved between him and his brother? Because this conflict between him is going to affect his children and his children's children way, way down the line. By the way, when Israel really needs Edom, Edom tells him to pound sand because this was never resolved. So what does he have to be afraid of? Go home to the land of your relatives. What does he have to be afraid of? He might as well have said out loud, go home to the land of one relative. Who's still there? Esau. Still have a problem with Esau? Yes. Even after nearly 20 years, he still has the same problem with Esau. Last we heard of Esau, is he real thrilled with this lying little mama's boy of a little brother? No. Should Jacob be afraid? I would. How was Esau described between the two? He was the big one. He was the muscular one. No wonder he was Isaac's favorite, right? Isaac loved Esau. He was a man's man. Jacob was small. He was small. He was mom's favorite. So he shouldn't be afraid. And by the way, when he sees that camp with those angels, and when he knows that God is with him, did he relax? Did he just say, hey, God has this under control? This is a covenant of faith. I just need to trust him. I just need to believe in him. Let me ask you this. Did his dad? No. Did his grandpa? No. Whenever it came time to be challenged by a king or someone else, what did they trust? Did they trust God that the covenant says, those who curse you, I will curse? No. They had to curse them themselves. She is my sister. They didn't trust that something was about to happen. So Jacob doesn't either. Jacob does what Jacob is going to do. He's going home, but he's going to Jacob this plan. He's going to manipulate this plan. He's going to do everything he can to make sure he comes out on top. Look what he does first. He sends messengers before him to his brother Esau, the land of Seir, the country of Edom. What's he want to do? He wants to test out the waters, right? I want to see what's happening here. And he instructs them. He says, thus you shall say to the Lord, my Lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have lived with Laban as an alien and stayed until now, and I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female slaves, and I have sent them to tell my Lord in order that I might find favor in your sight. He's going to Jacob his plan, isn't he? It's not just that he wants to test and see where Esau is with him. He's also going to what? He's bribing him, isn't he? And he looks like he's humbling himself. I'm your servant, calling him Lord. What you know about Jacob, just let me ask you, what you know about Jacob, let me ask you this, does he mean that? I don't think so. Do you? You know, by the way, sending a bride. It's his default mode. He's not trusting God. God's promise is that if Esau wants to curse you, God said, I'll take care of it. Does Jacob believe it? No. Just like his dad. Just like his grandpa. Cursed be everyone who curses you. And blessed be everyone who blesses you. Does this Jacobing work, by the way? does it happen? Does it work? Well, the messengers come back, and they say, we came to your brother Esau, and he's coming to meet you. And 400 men are with him. Did the bribe work? Well, not in Jacob's eyes, because he hits the panic button. Oh, no! Okay? He hits the panic button, and the Jacob plan goes into Jacob. And Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two companies. You could really, really spiritually dig into this. The camp where God was with the two angels is because of the two angels. He's playing God with this. He's dividing up into the two companies. Same way that God blessed the camp and made it two companies with the two angels. You could really dig in spiritually with this, couldn't you? He's playing what? He's playing God. Thinking, he says, he divides them up. If Esau comes to the one company and destroys it, then the company that is left will what? Will escape. Esau's going to kill him, so he figures, I can at least save half of my family, and I'll have survivors. That's a good plan for somebody who's always having to be in control. That's a good plan for somebody who has a talent to manipulate. It's a good plan for somebody who's trying to play God. But wait a second. Hold on a second. And this is the problem with leaving a conflict unresolved for 20 years. What did the servants tell him? All they said was that he's coming to meet you, and what? 400 men are with him. Nothing about what? Nothing about killing. What's going on? There's only one way Jacob can see this. There's only one way that he could look through his through a lens to his brother's eyes. It's with the unresolved conflict. It's what unresolved conflict does to us. It affects the relationship in that the relationship is not real anymore. Because the person who did the betraying has never, ever sought to do anything about it. The one who was betrayed, they never forgive. So the relationship really doesn't what? It really doesn't exist. You can't help but look at that person and look at that relationship without looking at it through these eyes, through the eyes of the unresolved conflict. The unresolved conflict was caused by Jacob's manipulation, and Jacob figures he can manipulate his way out of it. This is all it says. Does he take into account that Esau is now the ruler of his own nation? That he owns an entire nation, that he owns a whole country. 400 men is just the way he has to roll. Right? He can't take it into account because the burden that he has with his older brother can't be worked through. The deceiver and the thief of Esau's birthright is always going to see Esau through that light. So desperation drives him to do something desperate. And Jacob is about to do something that he has never, ever done before. This is how desperate he is. Guess what it is? What do you think it is before we take a look? He's going to do something so desperate that the manipulator, the heel grabber, he has never, ever done it before. You know what it is? He prays. And when I first came across this when I was studying, I said, you know what? And this is the first time he's ever prayed. So I went ahead, I went back to that verse. I went all the way back to that chapter where it says, what's his dad's name again? Isaac. When Isaac blessed him, I went all the way back to that chapter and I read all the way through. And I was right. Jacob's never prayed before. God's come to him, and the next day Jacob declares what he saw. Right? That's all he does. He's never, ever prayed before. Something real interesting when we look at our prayer lives, and something that if we ever make the mistake of thinking that we got something because we prayed, that something happened because we prayed, that I saw God's will because I prayed about it. Guess what? The entire covenant was given to a man who's never, ever prayed to God. Jacob said, O God of my father, Abraham, and God of my father, Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country, to your kindred, I will do you good. I told you this was coming, right? I'm not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you've shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed the Jordan, and now I have become two weapons. Now I've become two companies. I'm not 100% sure if he's bragging about his wealth or if he's actually recognizing the two companies. You said, I'll surely do you good. Make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted because of their numbers. Right. Deliver me, please, from the land of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I am afraid of him. He may come and kill us all, the mothers and his children. It's the first time he's ever asked God to do anything. But the thing, too, is that knowing what I know about him, see, because I have a lens in which I view Jacob, he's given me a pretty definitive lens in which to view him. Right? I'm not 100% sure about that prayer. Now, I don't believe that we should be judging anybody's prayers. I don't think that we should tell anybody that what they pray is right or wrong. In fact, I detest that. I hate that. That's why my least favorite theology books are books on prayer. Because when I see a book on prayer, I see somebody trying to teach me how to pray and to tell me that my prayers are all wrong. It's just the way that I see it. These words. You're the one that told me to return to my country. Sounds like his father Adam, doesn't it? And what happened? It wasn't me. It was the woman who you gave me. It's your fault. You told me you would do good to me and give me my covenant. You told me. If this doesn't work out, he already blames him. And note, he asks to be delivered from Esau's hand. But guess what he continues to do? He's going to continue to hedge his bet. He spent the night there, and from what he had with him, he took a present for his brother Esau. The bride that he hinted at when he sent the messengers to, now he realizes he has to what? Now I have to send it. So he takes a present for his brother Esau. Likewise instructed the second and the third and all who follow the droves, you shall say the same to Esau when you meet him. Moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us, for he thought, I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me, and afterwards I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. He just asked God to deliver him. He just appeared like he was going to trust in the covenant. The covenant says, those who curse you, I will curse. It looks like he was going to trust it. But what does he continue to do? Continues to manipulate. Continues to hedge his bets. And by the way, the selfishness in it. He sends them in companies and droves. Right? So one guy comes and says, here. Right? And then parts. And then a little while later, another one shows up. He's hoping that Esau will call it before he has to give everything away. If the first servant appeases him and he's not going to kill me, well, I don't have to give him the rest of what the other servants have. Nothing Jacob has done has been based on what? On faith. It's been his own manipulative plans. Ask God for deliverance, but I'm going to bribe Esau at the same time. Until the servants are gone, and his family is gone, and he is finally alone. He's alone. He's alone in the wilderness. It is pitch black. I want you to picture this now. The guilt of his sins against Esau and his father, they are first and foremost right there. His biggest fear is that Esau is going to kill him tomorrow. Which means he has to think about what? He has to think about what he did for the first time. There is nobody there but who? There's nobody there but him. You know, the more we know about God, the more he can reveal to us about ourselves. These moments right here, he's fearing for his life. He's fearing for the life of his wives and his children and his servants. The bitterest of all must be thinking that his own sin has endangered them. I'm going to watch my kids get executed tomorrow. and it's my fault from something that I didn't resolve for the past 20 years. Does he realize that? Does he know it? What happens to us when we do? How many here can remember that moment? How many here can remember that moment that you were a sinner and that it was real? How many here understood, completely understood, how selfish I really am? Here he is. It's got to be the deepest and darkest of despair. He's sitting alone, the terror of the blackest night. In Scripture, the wilderness is where bad things happen. It's almost supernatural. It's where the demons are. Satan tempts Jesus. He takes him where? He takes him to the wilderness. That's where they live. That's where all of this lives. And then all of a sudden, in the blackest of the night, what I picture is he feels a hand on his shoulder. What would you think? What would you do? He begins to what? He fights. Who does he think it is? You bet he thinks it's Esau. It's something he's not used to. He can't what? He can't run. He's right there. He has a hold of me. He can't do anything. He can't run from this one. Jacob was left alone, and the man went, wrestled with him. He has a hold of him. He wrestles with him until when? Until daybreak, until the dawn begins to break. He's been running from God. He deceives, he lies, he manipulates. He handles his habits his own way. He blames dad, he blames mom, he blames his father-in-law, he blames his wives, he probably blames his kids. So who does he sound like, y'all? I'm not going to speak for you, but he sounds like me. Sounds like all of us, doesn't it? And all of that has him where? He may not realize it, but it has him right where he needs to be. Because who has shown up? It's not Esau that's grabbed him. Who do we know has shown up? It's God that's grabbed him. It's not a dream anymore. It's not a voice in the night. It's not a bedtime story given to me by Grandpa and by Daddy. He's there now, and he's grabbed him. He's in a fight that he didn't pick, but that God picked this fight with him. He's in his wrestling match. Remember, I kind of pointed out with Abram. Abram gets the covenant. He breaks it. Realizes he breaks it. Builds an altar. Sacrifices to God. Does something worse, right? And after the something worse, remember, an intercessor was sent to him, Melchizedek. Okay, and he then after that he then impregnates Hagar. It gets even worse. But after the worst that you think that he can do, then what happens? No intercessor. No angel. God chosen. In what? In person. This is Jacob's moment. God says, all right, here we are, it's just you and me. Let's have this out. And the spirit of this is all through the prophets. The spirit of this is all through the Hebrew Scriptures. The spirit of it definitely is in the covenant. By the time that we get to Moses, you're going to understand, we really will understand what it means to truly walk and talk with God, how it affects us, who we become, what it is. Come, let us reach an understanding, says the Lord, he says to Isaiah to tell Israel. Your sins, like crimson, they can turn snow white. They're red as dyed wool. They can become like fleece. I know you don't think this makes any sense. I know, Jacob, you cannot get out of this yourself. I know this. Let's argue this out. Let's what? Let's wrestle. We can forget the whole point of the covenant was so that God could walk and to talk with his kids. It breaks his heart when we remain hiding in the bush. Where are you? And what have you done? And ever since Adam and Eve decided not to truthfully answer that question, what is it you've done? Ever since they decided that they would try to hem and haw their way out of it, they've still remained there in the bush, in hiding. But God was just asking for the very first time to ask his fallen children now to do something that we just simply cannot bring ourselves to do. What is it you've done? We need to work. We need to place ourselves in the area of need that all of the sick people that Jesus healed were in, and all of the spiritually sick disciples that come to him after. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they will be filled. We have hope that God is willing to wrestle with us, that he doesn't leave us in the bush, that he doesn't leave Jacob in the night, wondering whether or not he's taking his last breaths, and he has to do it alone. Nothing to hide behind, no manipulation, no right prayers, no paying my tithe, no eating the right things or the wrong things, nothing in between. No self-righteousness that is standing between us. Nothing but the raw terror of being a sinner and being in need. The match goes on. All night. The man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob. He struck him on the hip socket. Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he went. As he wrestled with it. Now Jacob knows he's in it. Something's happening that's never happened to him before. He's what? He's losing. By the way, if you're trying to wrestle somebody and your hip is dislocated, you're the one at the disadvantage. You may not realize it, but you're losing. He taps him on his hip. And the bone and socket that are being held by the strongest muscles in the human body have given way. Have you ever seen a dislocated hip? Okay, did you ever try to put one back in place, help a doctor put one back in place? There were two of us laying on his chest. We had to lay on his chest while this doctor stood on the table and was trying to pull this guy's leg up and over and out. Could not do it. There were four of us in there. He has to do it because Jacob is actually thinking up until then that he's winning. Willpower, resolve, desire to be good, it gets us where? It gets us nowhere. Jacob wants something. Jacob is a desperate man. He knows his chances are slipping away. And now with a dislocated hip, he hangs on and he digs in. And he absolutely digs in at Jake, and the angel says, God says, let me go. The day is breaking. Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you what? Unless you bless me. By the way, God is not trying to get away from him. God is reminding him what's supposed to happen at dawn. What's supposed to happen? Esau's waiting for him. So Jacob doesn't want to what? He doesn't want to go. So he is holding on to him. He's still edging his bet. Dawn's not here yet, and I still think Esau's going to kill me. I asked you, and this is it. This is all I've got. Now, I used to believe that this was not arrogance. This was not boasting. Okay? Even Patriarchs and Prophets says it's not arrogance or boasting. She says that it was the assurance of one who confesses his own unworthiness, yet trusts the faithfulness of a covenant-keeping God. Now, I have to give it to her there, but if she were here, I would argue about that. I don't think he is trusting in the covenant-keeping God at all. He's still trying to what? He's still trying to hold on. He's still trying to look for a blessing for something that has not occurred, which is the definition of what? Of faith. And he will not have faith. He will what? He won't let go. Oh, my plans have failed. My sins I can do nothing about. I've got no one else to blame. If that's his prayer, please, please. It should be his prayer. It isn't quite there yet. He's still hanging on to himself, and he knows it. And God knows it too. Because what happens next is going to resolve it all. What happened next was God said, "What is your name?" Up until now, Jacob's never had to connect the shame of his sin to his what? Has the blessings of the covenant, everything he's ever done has worked out. He believes it's because that he's so good at it. He believes maybe that because he's righteous of, in and of himself, that he's self-righteous. His plans has always worked out, and he's always seen it as prevailing. I was never Dad's favorite. Mom made me lie. My brother hates me because I was more clever than he was. Laban deceived me. Rachel and Leah are always fighting. The kids are always complaining that they don't get as much as my favorite kids. God is making me go home so I can be killed by Esau. It's all disarmed in one question. What is your name? You got to believe that after he was hanging on and he thought that he was doing so well and he recognizes who he's wrestling with, he's got to think, oh, you're going to bring that up now? You're going to bring that up? And all he says is, Jacob, are you happy? Yes, that's me. It's my name. It's not my mother's. It's not my father's. It's not my wife's, my kids, my coworker, who friend who betrayed me or was mean to me. It's not my pastor who ignored me. It's not my church who neglected me. It isn't my husband who won't cherish me. It's not my wife who hates me. It's me. Every betrayer, Jacob's. I'm the one. I'm the sinner. Confession isn't a religious duty. It's an authentic experience with God. It's a walking, talking, face-to-face relationship. When God said, "Where are you?" when he wanted to walk and talk with us, when he gave this covenant to them, he didn't want somebody who doesn't realize who they are. He doesn't want you. He doesn't want you to be the person that you think he wants you to be. He doesn't want you to thinking that someday you'll be worthy of this, that someday I'm going to get my act together and then I'll walk and talk with you. He doesn't want that either. I want Jacob, he says, I want you now. But I understand too what church I'm in. I've been preaching the gospel in this church for quite a long time, and I know somebody here who's saying, there he goes again. All he can talk about is sin. He just lives talking about sin. Sin, 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 sin. I had a member right here in this church standing at that very door that told me, Greg, I love the way you preach the gospel. I hate that you tell me that I always have to sin. That's what he got from this. I hate that you tell me that I always have to sin. I went back and I listened to a couple of sermons that I thought that maybe I knew what he was talking about. I never said that you have to sin. I'm not giving you permission. Who are they? What are they? What he wants is our authentic selves. That's what he wants. See, but the church doesn't teach that. The church teaches that God likes you when you get your act together. That's the God that you want to be. We strive to do this. So God just keeps all day, every day, just keeps walking in front of you with the carrot saying, you know, I will give you my covenant when you get your act together. Come on. And at the end of each day, he shows up and says, well, you blew it today, but let's try again tomorrow. And by the way, you can try a little harder. This is your fault. Are you wanting to get going, or are you wanting to go to move beyond our sin? Because you think that I spent way too much time talking about it. Come on, Pastor, let's get to the good stuff. The part where I can be better. The part where I get to be perfect. Let's go there. I agree. I want to get there. I want to mature. I want to be unto a perfect man, as Ephesians says. But let me ask you this. For all of our desire and the church's drive for that sanctified perfection, purpose. All the years that you've been in, let me ask you, are you any closer to that perfection that you strive for from the day that you came to Jesus? How much closer are you to it? We're not, are we? Because we need to remember what happens next. As soon as he confesses, as soon as he tells him that name that's been following him around from the time that he was born, that the sins that have been following him around since he was born, guess what he does? God says you'll no longer be known as that name. You'll be known now as what? Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and with mankind and with humans, and you've prevailed. Yisrael, that's your name now. Comes from two words, Sarah and El. Sarah means to strive, to wrestle, to argue out. It means to do that. And El, meaning God, wrestling with God. Not just wrestling with God, but what? Prevailing. Because that perfection, that being better, that being good, it doesn't come from our own willpower. It doesn't come from manipulating ourselves to get better. It doesn't come from being faithful about praying or not praying. It comes from believing that this is who you are. This is what God wants. You're no longer Jacob. You are now Israel. Mine. Jacob didn't prevail, did he? He got his hip broken. He got his hip dislocated. Did he win that wrestling match? No. But God says, I'll say that it is. I will reckon the victory to you as I reckoned faith and righteousness, reckoned righteousness to Abraham when he believed. He's telling Jacob, if you believe, then your grandfather's covenant is yours. It isn't your name anymore. But Lord, I know I'm going to mess up again tomorrow. God says, today is the day, you and me, now, today. If you don't think that I will walk with you again tomorrow, after you mess up again, where is your faith, Israel? Anyway, for those two who believe that when you're given this by grace, righteousness by faith, when you're given it by grace, that you automatically just get better and become perfect. You're no longer the manipulator. He gave him the name Israel. He just cleaned his slate, didn't he? He just told him, I'm going to reckon this to you as righteousness. The victory is going to be yours. Look what he does next. He called the place Peniel, saying, for I have seen God face to face, yet my life is preserved. He says, this doesn't make sense. He's good at this. He's good at proclaiming. You say, man, he understands it. He understands righteousness by faith. He's going to get better. He's going to be better. The very next words out of his mouth is Jacob asked him, please tell me your name. Why is it that you ask my name? He says. Jacob's trying to what? In the times in which he lived, the ancient times, the way that you got control of God was that you knew his what? You knew his name. If you knew his name, you're in control. What's Jacob trying to do? Even though God knows what he's trying to do, he still won't. Just get rid of your wounds. No longer are you in love. You're his man. The manipulator is still at it. But the covenant giver is still at it too. The beautiful verse in Romans 6 that says that sin, the law came in, sin began to hyperabound in God's law. He said, but he concludes by saying, and where sin hyperabounds, grace uberabounds. What he's saying is, every time you sin, you think, dang, I'm all the way up to hyper. I'm a hyper sinner. I'm way, way up there. Grace comes in and ubers it. Move the boundary to here. Listen, God says, I'm going to remove the boundary of grace there. I'm going to move it again. God says, I'm going to move it again here. You can't help sin God's grace. He's still squirming away. He's still trying. God says, comes a time when I'm going to break it to you as righteous. Your faith is what made you righteous. See, because something happens the next day. Something goes on the next day. He says, a big parade on a big long plane. Two big, huge families. And two brothers are going to come together in this life now. One is a big, red-headed guy who's bent over just a little bit because he's been carrying this grudge for way too long. And the other one's limping. He's got a glow on his face. The glow that comes from wrestling with God and being given the victory. No longer shall you be called Jacob. From here on out, you're Israel. Our covenant's action is this wrestling walk with God. Our covenant's action is not seeking a destination of sinless perfection. The journey of real confessing and authentic walk. In other words, the only way that I can approach him as one in need is I have to acknowledge my need. We wrestle with dislocated hips. It isn't going to be perfectly tuned and bodies that have gotten into shape. And I'm winning the war with my sin. I'm winning it every day. No, we will walk with these limps. We will walk with the dislocations. Why? Because the victory has been given to us. And all we need to do is believe that. The victory given. No longer are you Yaakov. No longer are you Jacob. From here on out, you are Israel. This one is my favorite. It's Jacob. In a lot of ways, I'm worse than Jacob. Because of his faith, because of the faith that God has given us, because of what Jesus has done for us, Israel can be our name too. It has to be real. To be offended. I acknowledge my limp. Dislocated my hip, I'm going to limp. And it said that Jacob fell on Esau's neck and then wept.